Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be around this great, big, wonderful world of ours. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. Sitting in for George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader. Thank you for joining me. And I've been hearing from many of you today that had a chance to see George live out in Arizona, and you guys said it was a fantastic program. Thank you very much for getting back to me and letting me know. George has got a bunch of great programs coming up live. He'll be in Las Vegas June 9th. From 5 to 8 at Silverton Casino Hotel in Las Vegas. He'll also be out in Asheville, North Carolina on Saturday, August 25th. You can find information about this by visiting coasttocoastam.com. Click on George and then the events, and you'll find all that information up. And you can go out and see George and some of the most fascinating guests live, be a part of live Q&As, discussions, and a lot of fun. So check that out for yourself. I am very psyched about tonight's show. I am fascinated, like many of you, with the stories of the strange and the supernatural. And one story that has really captured my imagination for years is the story of the Enfield poltergeist case. And this story resonates with me in many ways. And I've run the gambit of thoughts and emotions, and I've read and I've listened to interviews and watched documentaries and have vacillated back and forth on my trying to understand and wrap my head around what was actually going on. And as we know, most of what we see is presented through the eyes of Hollywood and entertainment. And getting to the real story, that's the intriguing part. On our show, Darkness Radio, we had a chance to interview Guy Lyon Playfair, who wrote one of the quintessential books on this case. And it is called This House is Haunted, The True Story of the Enfield Poltergeist Case, with Guy Lyon Playfair and Morris Gross. And it was a fascinating book. And we had a chance to talk with Guy before his passing. Unfortunately, we lost him. I believe it was on April 8th this year. And we heard his story, and we heard from his perspective. But here you've got a guy who makes a career out of writing books and traveling and seeing these things. So there's still that what-if quality to this. And I was able to capture a link through one of my listeners who passed on. They said, you've got to hear this interview. There was recently a radio show on BBC that did kind of this reunion talking to some actual eyewitnesses that were on site there witnessing this, skeptics, photographers, reporters, and I listened. I think I've listened to it about 7 times now. It was amazing. And on a lark, I reached out with Chris Boros, my producer, and I said, we've got to try to talk to these people. I think this is a fascinating aspect of the story, of the Enfield poltergeist story. This isn't the Hollywoodized version. This is coming at it from the eyes of a journalist whose journalistic integrity is on the line to report what she saw and witnessed, not just sensationalized, but what she actually saw, to remain objective in the presence of something extraordinary. And we're also going to talk to a man who was there as a prominent attorney, solicitor in England, and had a chance to question a spirit and talk to the spirit, talk to this being, whatever it was, himself. And that was intriguing to me. And I'm back on that scale of watching this. This is, I think, probably one of the most well-documented cases of paranormal activity ever, even outside of cases like the Amityville Horror or the Conjuring, the Perrin family. There is something different about this. I think in my estimation, from what I've read, really the only other case like this to this extreme that we're familiar with in the United States is like the Smurl haunting. And the parallels are very close. There were so many eyewitnesses, neighbors, friends, family, media, the police, and that's what you find in the Enfield case. But this wasn't a short-lived haunting. This was something that lasted almost 2 years and was witnessed by over 30 very good witnesses that saw these things and were trying to debunk, trying to understand and see how the fake and fraud could be going on. and were left scratching their heads. So our first 2 hours tonight is re-examining, re-exploring this 40-year-old case with two of the actual on-hand eyewitnesses. And that's exciting to me. And I hope that you guys are going to enjoy this as well. Later on in the show, we'll also be joined by a very remarkable man, Philip Smith. He's written a book called Walking Through Walls, a memoir. It is a remarkable story talking about his father, who was an interior decorator by day and a healer with supernatural powers and the ability to talk to the dead. And we're going to hear about his story a little bit later on in the show. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, get ready, buckle in. This is classic Coast to Coast that we have coming for you this evening, because we've got stories of supernatural, ghosts, and more. And Roz Morris and Richard Gross are on hand to spend this time with us. We'll be back. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Hello and welcome. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. And tonight, a look at the Enfield poltergeist case. Joining me this evening, Roz Morris has many years' experience as a broadcaster and media trainer. She co-founded TV News London in 1992 and is an accredited trainer for the Independent Television Association. She has been a news reporter, newsreader, and program presenter for BBC TV, ITN, Thames TV, and Tyne Tees TV, where she was the first woman in the northeast of England to be a regular presenter of the weekly political and business program. She also worked as a feature writer for the Evening Standard and a staff reporter and feature writer for The Observer and The Guardian, where she was the youngest reporter on both papers. Roz was one of the first reporters to look into the case of the Enfield poltergeist, and 40 years later, she's still baffled by it. Also joining us, Richard Gross, the son of lead investigator Morris Gross, the chief investigator of the Enfield poltergeist case and co-author of the book, This House is Haunted. He also still has his father's memoirs that speak to the case, and he hopes to publish those soon. He visited the house during the case and knows the truth about what happened there. He's a lawyer of 41 years and ran his own niche commercial real estate practice in 1984 till 2000, when he merged with one of the oldest City of London law firms, where he was a partner until 2015. Thank you both for being here and welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hello there.
Hello. And Richard, if you don't mind, let's start with you, and Roz will be working you through the show with us as well. But Richard, I want to ask a little bit about your family and setup. Your father being the lead investigator on this case, had he had a lifelong interest in the supernatural?
Yes, he had. He'd read around the subject. He was he was scientifically bent. Perhaps you might describe him as a mechanical engineer, because he, after the beginnings of his life and his first, he actually inherited a tobacconist and sweet shop from his father when he was a very young man, when he just got married. But he eventually turned into a businessman and an inventor, and he invented many very successful machines, advertising machines, and poster machines, and he was a very particular and grounded individual who liked to read around science and liked to read around things at the fringes of science. So he was very interested in the things that were of the very large and of the very small.
If I could ask real quickly, had he had experiences with what we might consider the paranormal throughout his life, or was it the lack of those experiences but everybody else's reports that really intrigued him?
No, I don't think he'd had experiences. Or if he had, he was probably like everyone else in this world. He rejected them, dismissed them, considered them to be coincidences, and continued with his life. So his interface with the paranormal only started after a rather tragic event in our family, which happened in 1976. He got married during the Second World War. He joined in 1939. He went on the British Expeditionary Force to France, and he was evacuated at Dunkirk. He was a captain in the Royal Artillery on the Over Channel guns. And just before the end of the war, he met and married my mother. They had three children, myself, my older sister Marilyn, and my younger sister Janet. And life was proceeding normally and successfully when one rather awful year, 1976, my younger sister, who was 22 at the time and was a cub reporter in south of Wales in Cardiff, was involved in a motorcycle accident. And she ended up in a hospital in Cardiff on a life support. And it was a very sad situation. My parents came across from their holiday in Jersey, which is an island off the south of England. I traveled from London, as did my sister. And we joined together in a hospital room in this hospital in Cardiff. And we saw my late sister Janet lying on the bed with her head swathed in bandages because she'd had serious head injuries, two black eyes, and she was in a hospital gown and she looked extremely forlorn. And we anguished over the next few hours, and it became apparent that the only thing to do was to switch off the life support machine, which we did, and so she died. And my parents stayed on to deal with formalities, and I took the train back to London, and I'd realized at that time that it was my birthday, and that my sister would definitely have sent me a birthday card in celebration. And I got rather nervous about this because the closer I got back to London, and I got back to the doormat of my house, and I was living at home with my parents at the time as a 25-year-old newly qualified lawyer, I realized that this card was going to be there, and I wondered what it would say. I got home and I saw the card on the mat, and I went upstairs and I sat on the bed and I opened this, and I was absolutely blown away with what I saw. She sent me a pre-printed cartoon card, and on the front of the card was a cartoon picture of a rather forlorn looking individual with head in bandages and black eyes in a hospital gown. And on the front it said, "I was going to send you a bottle of toilet water for your birthday." And on the inside it said, "But the lid fell on my head. Happy birthday." A strange, strange card in any circumstances. And she'd written in her own handwriting, with an arrow pointing to the ward, towards the word head, "And there won't be much of that less soon either. Lots of love, Jan, Welsh correspondent." Well, my breath was taken away. I was deeply shocked, because she'd actually predicted her own death in the most accurate fashion. I obviously told my parents about this, and there then began a number of coincidences, peculiarities about the circumstance, which resulted in my father saying to himself, "You know, this must be someone or something telling me to pursue what has been a lifelong interest in the paranormal into something a little bit more concrete." So he then sought out and joined the Society of Psychical Research, which had been founded in 1882 in the UK by a group of Cambridge scientists and scholars. And it has included over the years a prime minister and philosophers and politicians and physicists and Nobel laureates and masters of all their disciplines. And there began the story which became his connection with the Enfield poltergeist case.
Had he, in the movies, I know, and again, kind of going off the Hollywoodized versions of this, they portrayed that your mother was interested in mediumship and maybe trying to communicate with your sister. Was that a fact? Was your father open to that aspect of it, or were, you know, was that again just played up for the cameras?
Dave, I'm really happy you raised that, because when Sky Television were making their recent three-series drama called The Enfield Haunting, We discussed at length the degree of dramatization that would be appropriate for the program. And they couldn't resist. And they portrayed my mother in, I found, totally unacceptable terms. And part of this was to somehow attribute to her an extreme interest in mediumship and also a hostility towards my father's investigation, neither of which were true and couldn't be further from the truth. My mother was completely supportive of my father throughout all these investigations, and he always said that he could never have embarked upon this, which basically dominated his life and took him away from home and had him going to another house for hours, sometimes even days at a time. He couldn't have done that without the support of his wife. And my mother at all times was considerate of this and knew that it was important for my father to pursue his interest. Now, that's not to say that deep in the recesses of her mind, she didn't want to, you know, contact her late daughter again. It would be unnatural for any parent not to want to do that. But she certainly didn't let that. She didn't impose herself in any way on this investigation.
Was it strange for you to see your father portrayed in not one but two pretty major presentations, the Enfield Haunting, which was, as you said, a three-part special and in TV in England, and then, of course, The Conjuring 2, the Enfield Poltergeist case come out. Was it weird to kind of watch your father's life play out in this Hollywoodized versions?
Yes, of course it was. In some ways, I'm proud that his memory, continues to a certain extent. And, to be honest with you, in the Society of Psychical Research, his attitude towards the paranormal, his attitude of practical investigation, was lauded by the members, because a society, when it involves itself in study, can sometimes forget that, it's raison d'etre to get out there into the field. And my father was a field investigator for 28 years. No, it was strange. Obviously, one had to come to terms with the misinterpretations and the colorings and the dramatization.
But with that said, both movies portrayed him as a very loving and caring, gentle man towards this family and what they were dealing with. Do you feel that was a fair representation of your father?
Yes, I do. To an extent. I mean, he was, for example, a lifelong vegetarian, and he didn't even wear leather. So he tried to wear non-leather shoes or belts or whatever. He was a great lover of animals, and in the Enfield Haunting the Sky presentation, they had him carving a piece of lean beef, which could never have happened in a month of Sundays. It was things like that irritate. But of course, I suspect to the mass audience, it means absolutely nothing, because you have to know the sort of the inner workings of the mind of my father. But the generality of what was being said, I think, was important. I think when it departed from, when either program or indeed any presentation departs from recording what happened and then discussing it, I always find that a little bit difficult. And I was greatly heartened when I came on the line just before 6, it was 6 o'clock in the morning in London time, and I heard someone say, "We are just going to consider the facts." And I thought, well, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to consider the facts of what happened. And then, extraordinarily enough, one of the advertisements that you had just before we came on was from someone who was saying, "This is the way I should be speaking." And he was elongating his voice. And then he coughed and he spluttered because, that was an unnatural way of doing things. And I suspect we'll come on to that during the course of this discussion, because that's precisely one of the criticisms of the voice at the Enfield Poltergeist case, and of the comments being that no one could do what that voice did.
We're going to get into that. We'll talk about that, and I'll even see if our producer can maybe find. I know there's quite a bit of that audio that exists on YouTube and other places, and perhaps we can pull up some of the vocalizations that was recorded for later on in the program. And when we come back, we have to take a break. We'll come back. We'll introduce Roz and discuss how she became a part of this story. As I said, this is probably one of the most eyewitnessed paranormal encounters ever recorded. And with so many eyewitnesses, from the police to the media to clergy, family, friends, and more, this is a story unlike any other we've told. Stay tuned. We've got more coming your way on Coast to Coast AM. In August of 1977, a single mother, Peggy Hodgson, called police to her rented home in Enfield after two of her four children claimed that furniture was moving and knocking sounds were heard on the walls. The children, Margaret, age 14, and Janet, 11, a police constable said that she saw a chair wobble and then slide across the floor. Later, there were claims that included disembodied voices, loud noises, thrown rocks, toys, overturned chairs, and children levitating. This was covered by British newspapers and news such as the Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror until reports came to an end in 1979. When we return, we'll speak to the first reporter on the site to look at this case and really watch it evolve. Roz Morris joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. We're back on Coast to Coast AM. Roz, there is the strange activity, things moving around, banging noises coming from the wall. They run to the neighbors. Neighbors come over and investigate it. When they can't figure it out, they call the police, who then witness it for themselves. How did you get introduced to the story in this case? What was that introduction for you?
Well, what happened was, in media terms, it was very simple. The family, having called the police, and the police said, well, they couldn't do anything because there was no offence being committed, so they didn't know what to do about anything strange. The family then called the Daily Mirror, which is a British newspaper. And in those days, you've got to remember, in media terms, 40 years ago, this is a long time ago, and people actually stuck with one newspaper throughout their life, and they really, were very loyal to their paper, and they thought that the Daily Mirror might actually help them. And the Mirror only sent a photographer and writer along because they were told that the police had been and had seen things happen. So they thought, well, maybe there is something happening here. Anyway, I was a radio reporter for BBC Radio, and it was a Saturday. The Mirror came out with a front page story called The House of Strange Happenings, which is pretty unusual to run what you might call a ghost story on the front page. So you can tell there wasn't a lot of news around, really. And it was a very slow news day. I was working on the Saturday for a program which was going out on the Sunday. It's called The World This Weekend. It goes out on BBC Radio 4. Here in the UK, and I was working for that program, and it was a slow news day, and I was told all day, we haven't got enough to fill the program. If nothing else comes up, you'll just have to go out on this ghost story, and you'll have to go to Enfield. And nothing came up, so early evening I set off and went to Enfield, and I met Mrs. Hodgson, and I met Maurice Gross, and I met the girls, and I did a report the next day on the Sunday in the World BBC program, The World This Weekend, and that took up about 10 minutes of the program, and it included my recordings and then an interview with me by the presenter. And I must say it was extremely strange right from the start. I found the whole thing very strange.
Well, let's talk about that. You get, you know, informed that this, we want you to go cover. If there's nothing else to fill, we want you to go. And you're going to go to this, you're hearing what the weird stuff is. Is there any part of you that's kind of nervous about going to this, or is this something you totally dismiss as an impossible task?
No, well, I don't remember being nervous. I just thought this is very strange. I just thought, well, this is a very odd story. I had an open mind about it, but I was pretty skeptical, actually, in many ways, because I thought, well, what can be going on? What on earth is happening?
And did you have a chance to talk to the constable that actually witnessed the chair moving across the floor?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I didn't actually, in all the time that I went to the house, I didn't actually see anything moving about. But I did hear the knocking sounds, and I did record them, and I did record the strange voices, which we've already mentioned, which seemed to come from near the girls. But on the first night, I talked to Maurice Gross, and I talked to Mrs. Hodgson, who seemed to me to be a very ordinary, straightforward sort of woman. And I broadcast my report, and I did hear something crashing upstairs while the girls were asleep, and it appeared that a chair had moved across the room while the girls were asleep without them getting out of bed to throw it. I mean, I don't know because I wasn't in the room, but it definitely was very unnerving. Anyway, after all this, I decided that it was an interesting story, and I proposed to the BBC Radio that I should do a documentary about it, a radio documentary. And so I went back to the house many times and broadcast the documentary at the end of 1978.
When you talk about the knockings and the bangings, I mean, did it sound like it was a distant knock that could have been on like an outside wall, or did it sound like the banging was coming from within the house itself?
Well, it's very difficult. You know, people ask about this, and it's very difficult to describe. I think it's it was just very strange that there was this sort of knock, 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 knock all the time, and it would sound from different parts of the wall. It might sound as though it was upstairs, and then it might sound as though it was downstairs. It sort of moved around. It was odd.
Richard, could I ask? You hear knocks in walls. I mean, old houses have this. You've got pipes that expand. You've got wood that expands and contracts. What type of things would your father and Guy Lyon Playfair, the two main investigators on this case, what would they do to look to debunk these weird noises?
Well, first thing is that one of the neighbors, Vic Nottingham, he was a roofer, very down-to-earth working man. And the first thing he did was he went around the house, and he, you know, examined everything that he could and said, well, I can't see any cause of the knocking. Everything that happened there, the knocking, the strange events, Guy and my father checked and rechecked as much as they possibly could. And this is one of the features of the case. The instinct is always to ignore, dismiss, come up with a reason why something didn't happen, or whatever the case may be, you know. And they were very aware of this. It followed them all the time. It's the nature of investigation, particularly of something which is, you know, so peculiar. So with their recording machines and their cameras and their discussions, they went over and over everything that happened, and they, where they felt they could invite people to check things and check their own sanity on their own, what they saw with their own eyes, they did. And throughout the entire 18 months or so of the manifestation, no one could come up with a reason, a practical reason, why the things that happened. And that's just a fact that one has to take on board and move on with.
How long did this investigation go before you decided to visit as well, Richard?
Well, I was, I said, living at home at the time, and every morning before I went off to my office, my father would come to the breakfast table and play me a tape of what had been going on at the house. And it started off with, you know, knockings and bangings and scrapings and bashings and screams and God knows what, which, to be quite frank with you, was a bit water off a duck's back for me because, you know, I was a lawyer. You know, I'm trained to see things in a certain way, and I had my life to lead and frankly wasn't prepared to get involved with my father's life. And so after a while, he was religiously playing these things for me morning after morning. So I said to him, look, Dad, when this thing can talk to me, I'll go. But up until then, you know, I'll listen politely, but please don't expect me to come along. And one day, I could, you know, after the progression of knockings, which became sentient, in other words, there was a discussion involved when my father or Guy would say to whatever was there, knock twice for yes or once for no, and they started to have these sort of conversations as resulting from knocking. One day, my father played me a tape. He was absolutely triumphant. He was ecstatic. And the tape went something like this, and you'll forgive me, I practiced the voice many times that you'll hear. It's not far. I'm quite good at it now. But I do say that it lasts only for a second. I couldn't do it for very long. He said to the entity or whatever it was, look, you're very clever. You know, you can respond two knocks for yes and one knock for no, but I think you can do better than that. So why don't you say my name? Nothing. So he said, come on, say my name, Morris. And then came Morris. Well, that was extraordinary. So my father said, well, that's very good, but say my whole name, Morris Gross. Morris, Morris. I heard that exactly like that. As I said, I practiced it many times. And I thought, unbelievable. Okay, Dad, I'm going. And so we arranged for a visit.
Roz, how long were you there investigating this before the voices? I mean, you were going through the, you know, hearing of the furniture moving, banging noises, knockings, things moving about. But how long was it for you before the voices started manifesting?
Well, I first went there in the September. I went back in the October. And the voices started, I believe, sort of in November. And I first recorded them in the December. And I recorded these strange voices, which were in the same, very deep voices, which were in the same room as Janet and Margaret. And I did, they did keep up these voices, or if it was them, or the voices kept going, we don't know actually what it was. But the voices kept talking for, you know, an hour, 2 hours at a time. And that's really difficult. I did actually try to do the voice myself. I did try and do this really deep voice, and I had a sore throat after doing it for a minute. I mean, it's really difficult to do. So when people said, oh, it must be ventriloquism, I don't know how any ventriloquist could do that voice, not for the length of time that this went on for.
You said that these voices, this voice would talk for hours. Would it be coherent, regular one-on-one conversation? Was it ever a pleasant conversation, or was it always guttural, barking at you, you know, cursing, saying hateful things? Tell us a little bit about what the actual exchange would be like.
Well, a lot of it was fairly childish. There was swearing and some sort of, you know, strange sort of childish stuff. At first, it was very hostile and didn't want to talk, and then eventually it did start to talk. And then, of course, after that, Morris Gross recorded the voice telling him that it was the voice of someone who had died in the house, which when I heard about that, I must say the hair stood up on the back of my neck because I thought that was very strange.
You're hearing this voice. Now, I've got to say, and if people check it out on YouTube, there is video footage of Janet speaking, and you can hear this kind of, you know, froggy
that's,
voice that's coming
another out. BBC reporter, a TV reporter,
right,
who also did a report on the case.
Now, watching it, that was part of what made me a skeptic at the beginning, because growing up in the United States, and I'm not sure how prevalent it was for you, there were the Little Rascals, the R Gang shorts, and there was a character by the name of Froggy who spoke like this through most of the episodes, and he had this kind of weird, deep, creepy voice that was just part of it. And, you know, he sustained it for the entire episode, and we understand there's editing and things that go on behind it. But to me, it just sounded like when I was a kid, my friend and I used to talk to each other like that all the time because we just thought it was a weird, funny voice to do. So when I heard that, that to me kind of, I stepped out of belief until you start to listen. And like, I know your father's recordings are really a lot more chilling. The voice goes from that kind of sounding like a kid talking gruff to this kind of voice that's above that. And it sounds more like a grumbly old man.
If you just chip in there, Dave.
Right.
You know, you talked about, you know, checking. And of course they did check. They checked everything. They brought in a specialist in the human voice, and he and they checked it from a scientific perspective. They brought in a ventriloquist and challenged them to you know, reproduce the voice. They even at one stage asked Janet to put water, you know, swallow some, well, not swallow, put water in her mouth, and they taped her mouth, and the voice continued notwithstanding. And of course, it's frankly absurd to think that an 11-year-old girl can go on and speak like this. It's just not physically possible. So there comes a time when you sort of run out of,
right,
of potential answers, and you actually have to turn around and say, you know something, it happened.
Nathan, my producer, do you have any of the audio of the voice so we could play that before we go to the break here? All right, go ahead. And this is some of the actual recording. This is the voice that would emanate around or near this 11-year-old girl, Janet.
Rawr, rawr, look up, check you down the street. Merrily, 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 lovely, past the train. Now, f***ing smile.
I want you to tell me whether you remember what happened to you when you died. Just before you died and just after you died.
Days before I died, my day, I went blind. Then I had an hemorrhage and I fell asleep and I died in a chair. In the corner downstairs.
Was that, Richard, was that you questioning her at that point?
It was. It was extraordinary. It was the one and only time that I visited the Enfield house. And I am, to my knowledge, the only member of the Law Society ever to have interviewed a ghost.
You speak to this entity, and when you're sitting there, now, again, in the video, if people go watch on YouTube, there are videos where you see her mouth moving and the voice coming out. But then you said there's other times that, like, she held a mouthful of water, they taped her mouth, and you could still hear the voice. And in interviews with both of you, you would say that the voice seemed to be in the room near or behind the girls, but not necessarily emanating from the girls.
That's right. It was a discarnate voice. This is how my father described it in Guy also. It appeared to center itself on Janet. One of the specialists in the voice said it came from the false vocal fold, or what? I think, Roz, you know the precise phrase. I think I've forgotten it. But
yeah, false vocal fold, yes.
We're at a break. Hold on 1 second. We'll come back. We've got to hit the top of the hour break here. We'll come back. We've got more on the Enfield Poltergeist with our guests, Richard Gross and Roz Morris. When we return, I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.